I'm very concerned if we don't pass this bill today that this will be an initiative.
If they don't listen to the will of the people will speak.
We can be reasonable, we can communicate, we can be respectful, we can be civil, we can find common ground.
And if our partners buckle under this political pressure, if the hard choices just become too hard, then we'll just keep moving forward.
Mr. Speaker, in conclusion, the $10 founding father without a father who got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter, by 14, they place him in charge of a trading charter.
Welcome to 45 Days, a KUER news podcast where we break down week by week the bills, the lawmakers, and events of the 2017 Utah legislative session. I'm Terry Gilday, KUER's news director, and I'm in studio with reporters Whitney Evans, Julia Ritchie, and Nicole Nixon. Hi.
Hi there.
Week four of the legislature, and it just keeps getting better and better. I think this is our booze and guns episode.
Let's start with
booze. HB 155, this is Norm Thurston's bill that would lower the legal intoxication limit for individuals from 0.08 to 0.05. That would give Utah the lowest threshold for intoxication levels in the nation. This is happening in other countries around the world, but not in the United States. Whitney, you were at the hearing. Let's talk about this. What do you think is the motivation for doing this bill?
Yeah, and first of all, so the meeting actually took place late last week, but we weren't able to cover that in last week's podcast. So we're doing it this week. Republican Representative Norm Thurston presented House Bill 155 in committee. It passed 9-2. And Thurston had, to make his case, essentially, he had a representative from the National Transportation Safety Board make the argument that a 0.05 BAC will change people's behavior. And the logic behind that is that it's so easy to reach that 0.05 BAC. Most people just say, hey, I'm not going to drink any amount of alcohol before I drive just to be safe. And the argument against the current BAC, which is 0.08, is right now people can say, well, I can go and have a couple of beers after work maybe and drive home and I'll be fine. I'm not breaking any laws. Thurston wants to change that culture. And just for fun, I did a quick calculation online, and I'm an average size woman, and we don't need to get into weights or anything, but I could have two glasses of wine in the span of an hour and still be under that 0.05 BAC. But if one of my more petite girlfriends, like Nicole or Julia, for instance, has two glasses of wine, they would likely be over the legal limit of 0.05. So this makes me the designated driver, obviously.
I'm a lightweight.
Yeah, so the most interesting thing I think that happened at this meeting is that when the representative of the National Transportation Safety Board laid out some data in front of state lawmakers that said, for instance, 0.05 BAC nationwide would lead to an 11% decrease in fatal alcohol crashes, saving 1,800 lives, it completely shut down any argument speaking against lowering the BAC. That data that she brought in really sealed the deal.
Well, it's interesting. I question sort of on a larger sort of cultural perspective what is motivating this. You know, whenever we have alcohol reforms that loosen alcohol restrictions or laws in the state, there's always something else that comes in that strengthens enforcement or strengthens laws. And years ago, when we got rid of social clubs in Utah, that was the birth of the Zion Curtain. This year, we're talking about getting rid of the Zion Curtain. And I'm wondering, and again, this is an open question, we don't really have an answer for it, but is this part of the culture in Utah where if we loosen alcohol laws, we have to find some law that strengthens enforcement or becomes more strict? Is that just a sort of a politics thing?
I don't think it is. I saw that we weren't at the Senate media availability today, but the Salt Lake Tribune did a quick article that said that Senator Jerry Stevenson, who is the Senate sponsor of this much-anticipated alcohol reform bill that Republican Representative Brad Wilson is working on, he said that Zion Curtain repeal, whatever bill, is coming out very soon. He did say that this bill by Representative Thurston is independent of that. So who knows?
We know people have said this connection, this sort of give and take relationship has existed in the past with bills. But who's to say? Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't with this bill. We'll see. But it passed 9-2. So there's obviously some appetite for this bill.
Jess, I just want to throw some data out there, and I don't want to diminish drunk driving. It's not an activity anyone should be a part of. And I don't want to discount individuals who have had a brush with tragedy due to drunk driving, but just a few numbers about where Utah sits on this. So I've got some 2015 numbers. This comes from the Foundation for Advancing Alcohol Responsibility. This is a think tank out of Arlington, Virginia. The latest data is from 2015. And so there were 10,265 alcohol-impaired driving fatalities in that year. And the amount that happened in Utah was only 43, whereas in Texas it's 1,323. So 10% of those 10,000 happened in a state like Texas, but in Utah, very few are happening. Not to say that there's anything wrong with this bill or there's anything wrong with trying to keep people from getting behind the wheel who are intoxicated, but I wonder what the motivation is specifically for this. And there were some individuals at the hearing that said that this might not be such a great idea, Whitney, right?
There were only three people who spoke out against this, but Sean Druyan, this Davis County defense attorney, was one of those three people. He had a couple of different arguments. One, he feared it would lead to an increase in DUI arrests. He'd have more clients, and his clients would have a lot of problems. He makes a distinction between DWI and a DUI. Someone can currently be under the legal limit and still get a DWI, and the punishment isn't as harsh as a DUI. And if this limit is lowered, his clients could more likely get a DUI than a DWI, which could mean more problems for them.
The main effect that has on my client is them losing their license. And if they lose it for 120 days, they're usually going to lose their job. If they lose their job, they're not going to be able to provide for their family. And oftentimes, it's just a spiral downhill. If they get an impaired driving, however, they're not going to lose their license. They're going to keep their license. And the courts don't send to the driver's license division any kind of a record that they got an impaired driving, and therefore they keep their license, they keep their job. And for most first-time offenders, it's a wake-up call. They don't know that they're even impaired to the point they can't operate their vehicle.
So that's Sean Druyan, Davis County defense attorney, speaking against House Bill 155. He brought up potential effects on tourism. There's already that stigma around Utah alcohol laws. This would just be another reason for people to say Utah isn't friendly or accommodating for drinkers. And he said if Utah were sincere about saving lives, lawmakers would do things like lower the speed limit. Representative Paul Ray, however, he was in favor of House Bill 155. He voted for it. He wasn't having any of those arguments.
You talked about people lose their jobs.
Yeah.
I lost my grandfather. I'd much rather some SOB who's drinking lose his job than somebody have to lose a father, a grandfather, or a child. Also, you seem to put tourism over life. To me, life is more important than tourism money.
Strong words there from Representative Paul Ray.
Yeah, obviously very emotional topic. And, you know, back to when Sean Druyan made the case that lawmakers should think about, you know, lowering the speed limit. The argument was made that UDOT data, Utah Department of Transportation data, showed in the past that increasing the speed limit does not increase the risk of crashes. So, there wasn't a whole lot of opening for discussion about, tourism and DUI arrests versus the sanctity of life.
So, Whitney, where does the bill stand now? It passed out of committee, correct?
It passed out of committee 9-2, and now it's on the third reading calendar on the House floor. And it's pretty far down the line, so it might be the last few days of the session before we get to get back to the discussion on this bill.
We'll definitely keep our eye on it. Let's move on to the guns part of the episode. Julia, you covered HB 237. This is the Firearms and Domestic Violence Amendments. This is Representative Lee Perry's bill. This bill would do away with concealed carry permits and give law enforcement some tools to deal with perpetrators of domestic violence and weapons. Tell me more about this bill and what happened in the committee.
Yeah, so this is an effort that Utah has tried to undertake a few times. There are a lot of states out there that don't have permits or don't require permits for concealed carry, but Utah is one of them. So Guns 101, Utah, you can carry a firearm out in the open on your hip in your holster, you know, however you've gotten that, and it has to be unloaded, but you don't have to have a permit to do that. However, once you decide to put it in your purse, or as Representative Perry likes to point out, put a jacket on because it's cold outside or there's rain coming down, you have to have a permit because that's a concealed carry. So his argument for this bill is basically that's ridiculous. We obviously, like, these are law-abiding citizens. Most people do take safety courses and the other things that are already required for the permit. So we should just strengthen domestic violence laws and at the same time get rid of the permitting requirement.
What I'm suggesting here is because somebody put a coat or a shirt over their gun, we're going to make them a criminal. That's the only difference. It's the same person. They haven't changed people at all. They're still law-abiding citizens. All they've done is covered the gun up. It's still unloaded. It still fits all the same definitions that it did before. And I'm saying that's okay.
So, Julia, what are the domestic violence provisions in this bill? What is in the legislation that would help law enforcement with domestic violence?
One would require enhanced notification among local agencies. So if someone who had a domestic violence charge on their record was flagged while they were trying to buy a gun, let's say they were in Salt Lake, but they lived in like Weber County. Salt Lake Police doesn't right currently have to tell Weber County where he lives. They just have to notify Salt Lake where he tried to buy it, the gun shop is, that is. So this law would have made it so that when the gun owner says, hey, you're not supposed to buy a gun, he tells Salt Lake, then Salt Lake would have to tell Weber County. So a little bit more protection for people who might try to cross county lines and try to get a gun. Another thing would be taking away guns from people who have had a domestic violence charge against them, even if they didn't use a gun during that incident. So this bill had the funny distinction of having enemies from both the gun control lobby and the NRA, who said that those were overly broad, those provisions were overly broad and infringed on personal freedoms. And the gun control lobby obviously just doesn't like the fact that getting rid of permits means like easier access to guns.
So trying to please everybody, it pleases no one.
Exactly. And that's what a lot of the committee members said. It ended up going to a tie vote, which I think surprised a lot of people in the room. There was some emotional testimony on both sides, including a survivor of the Trolley Square shooting who said that she was opposed. And then there was a domestic violence survivor who said that, no, she would like faster access to a gun if she was in a situation that she needed to protect herself. But in the end, 5-5 vote ended up stalling committee, and some of the members said, you know, this bill is just trying to do way too much.
I remember back in 2013, actually, when Governor Herbert vetoed the concealed carry bill that lawmakers passed. And I remember talking to him after he vetoed that bill and him saying essentially, you know, Utah gun laws are fine. They don't need to change. There's no reason for a bill like this to exist. I wanted to go back to, you said gun laws 101, something I learned recently and it surprised me. Unloaded actually doesn't just mean unloaded. Unloaded in Utah means you can't have a round in the firing position. It has to be quote unquote, two mechanical actions from firing. So that's just an interesting point to make, that concealed carry means you do actually have bullets in that gun. But
so you can have a loaded clip, but you can't have a round in the chamber that you can fire. Correct.
Yeah. So it's not like you're walking around with an empty gun.
Yes. Now that's great clarification. So there was a 5-5 vote, but two individuals on the committee were not present, Republican Eric Hutchings and Democrat Angela Romero. I was talking to Robert Gerke from the Salt Lake Tribune on Radio West on Thursday, and he thinks that Eric Hutchings, who evidently had some personal crisis at the time, couldn't make it to the hearing, will come back and break the tie vote. I don't know what the status of Angela Romero was or why she wasn't at the hearing or where she stands on the bill. So it's possible this could come back. A 5-5 vote, it stalled in committee, so essentially the legislation at this point is dead. But two members of the committee weren't present. They haven't weighed in on their votes yet. This could come back. So we definitely need to keep our eyes on that. Let's move on to another really interesting bill that passed the House on Wednesday this week, although on a quite a controversial vote. This is HB 93. These are judicial nomination amendments from Representative Merrill Nelson. Nicole, you were on the floor on Wednesday covering this legislation. What is this? What would this legislation do if passed?
So this would change the process for nominating judges. And currently, so this the Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice sends names when there's a judicial vacancy. They compile and send a list of names to Governor Herbert, who then picks his nomination from that list of names. So the CCJJ is really what vets these potential judges, and they use all these different criteria like experience and integrity, legal knowledge, and temperament is one while they're considering these judges. Now, they can consider race and gender, and they say that they can use that as a consideration when they have two sort of equally qualified candidates. So Representative Nelson is running this bill, and he's got two arguments against this His first is that the CCJJ shouldn't be making these rules and creating these criteria for evaluating and considering judges, that the state legislature is the one that should be setting this criteria. He says it's a legal and a constitutional issue mainly. So the bill would adopt the CCJJ's current criteria of considering experience and integrity and all these things, except for the consideration of race and gender. He says that race and gender shouldn't be considered. They shouldn't be considerations. That when picking judges, they should only focus on experience and merit.
I am not saying that we should not have diversity on our bench. I'm not saying that we should not have women, men, people of different races. That's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that, as long as they are the best we can find, as long as we are focused on merit.
So this got a lot of pushback, mostly from Democrats, and one of those is Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck. She is Latina. She brought up some statistics. She said that while 13% of Utah's population are Hispanic, 18%, more than 18% of Utah inmates are Hispanic, and while Utah's population is 1% African American, the population of Utah inmates is more than 6% African American. So there's a bit of disparity there. And she talked about how having a group of diverse judges in the state could help, you know, even out those numbers a little bit.
The experience comes from life and from living life. And when individuals come to the table that are diverse and provide that additional experience, I think you will see improvements related to incarceration levels, and there will be more equity and fairness within our community.
You know, Nicole and I were talking about this a little bit earlier today, about how the CCJJ's criteria is essentially the same logic behind the federal affirmative action law, which does exactly what CCJJ's criteria does. It's all about organizations actively working to promote diversity, and denying race as a factor is sort of a very colorblind passive move in a way. So I was just thinking about how lawmakers essentially, in voting for this bill and doing away with that consideration, are in a sense revealing their thoughts or their feelings on the federal affirmative action law.
Yeah, and I talked to Representative Merrill Nelson after this passed the House, and he seemed to feel like I don't know, maybe in all aspects of life we shouldn't see race, that shouldn't even be a consideration, because we should just focus on who's the most qualified. But so a few Republicans actually joined the House Democrats in voting against this bill. One of those was Representative Lowry Snow from Santa Clara. He's a Republican. He's an attorney. And he gave a bit of a passionate argument against this bill. And he said that it's important for the judiciary in the state to reflect the state's population.
Is it not an important function of that process when we have just as many women coming before our courts, just as many women coming for a judge to seek justice, for that person to know that this state feels strongly enough about having not just good, qualified, competent judges, but judges that reflect what the makeup is of our state? Is that not at least a consideration?
So he hinted there that only about a quarter, maybe, of judges in Utah are women. He argued that it's important to not only have a diverse group of people, but a group of people with diverse backgrounds and diverse life experiences.
I think it was a fascinating debate on the floor, and with a vote of 47-25, there's a sizable amount of Republicans really who are questioning this. It's passed the House. We'll see how it fares in the Senate, but I imagine we'll see more Republicans on the Senate side questioning whether this is a good idea or not. We'll definitely keep our eyes on it. So we've gone from booze and guns. I think we should end the episode with polygamy and bigamy, right? Wouldn't that
sounds
be,
about right?
Absolutely.
I mean, lawmakers considered a bill this week, HB 99. These are what are called bigamy offense amendments. This is Representative Mike Noel's bill that would essentially make bigamy a second-degree felony in the state if child abuse is connected to the crimes. A few other provisions. This sparked a huge rally up at the Capitol of polygamists, both for polygamy and then those against it as well. Julia, you covered this. What was the scene of this rally?
It was unusual. Before I moved to Utah, you know, I'd watched like half a season of Big Love on HBO and maybe like one half episode of Sister Wives. So when I actually saw the stars of Sister Wives marching up the steps of the Capitol, I was like, this is unusual. And in fact, it was like the first time that Cody Brown and I think a few of his wives who joined him had been back in the state of Utah since they sued the state of Utah a few years ago over their bigamy law. And so the bigamy law has sort of been in this weird legal limbo that Mike Noel, Representative Mike Noel, is trying to clean up now. And essentially, he wants to reassert the bigamy like law. So it is a felony to be married to more than one person at a time in the state. But rarely do they prosecute this without some other really bad offense. So mention child abuse, sex abuse. And
Domestic violence,
which there is a history. In these
or tax fraud.
Yeah. Again, these groups have a long, sordid history of a lot of issues like that. So essentially, he wants to make it tougher for them to commit these kinds of abuses. So he held a press conference with about, half a dozen former polygamists who have escaped, all women, told their stories, a lot of sad stuff there. And then they went outside and 200 people marched up, mostly from southern Utah, lot big families, to say this is a matter of religious liberty, this is religious freedom. Look, we're not victims here. Their wives are holding signs that say, you know, it's my right. Little kids are holding signs that say, I heart all my moms. and then the anti-polygamists are standing right next to them saying, see, these guys are crazy. So, it's an interesting bill. It did receive a favorable recommendation, and right now I think it's being held on the reading calendar before it gets heard in the House. So
should appear on the House floor maybe early next week.
It's interesting, you know, the fight over marriage equality in Utah back in 2014 for legal gay marriage kind of emboldened polygamists in the state, because it reintroduced this idea that you should be able to marry anybody and even marry a number of consenting adults if all those individuals in that relationship consent. And so it's also emboldened this religious liberty idea. But it's interesting, you know, I heard in your story, Julia, you had a piece of tape from Representative Mike Noel where he was talking about this sort of in terms of his LDS faith, and that polygamy and bigamy is kind of an affront to the LDS faith, even though it has historical roots in the LDS faith, yet the FLDS and others have been using polygamy as part of their ministry and faith. And his motivations are interesting.
His exact words were, I'm tired of them hijacking my religion.
Yeah.
So pretty strong feelings by him. And again, he represents a part of the state where a lot of these compounds exist in southern Utah. So, and they were there and they're very unhappy with him too.
Well, we've got a lot to keep our eyes on. Great talking with you. Julia Ritchie, Whitney Evans, Nicole Nixon, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
45 Days is a production of KUER News. JT Nebaker composed our music. Tim Slover and I produced this episode. I'm Terry Gilday.